By 1758, things were not going well for the British in North America. Across the pond in London, the same could be said for the government. Just as there was infighting among the military officers, there was also political fights going on in Parliament. England was in shambles, as Secretary of State William Pitt the Elder had become known as the Great Commoner by the people, and had built up a reputation as a firm and good leader. But even though the people of England adored him, the politicians had conspired to oust him from the government. William Pitt's successor, though, the Duke of Devonshire, had a rough go of it, and was practically forced out of the office within months. Pitt would form a coalition government with the Duke of Newcastle. The Pitt-Newcastle coalition would end a period of political instability at the height of the Seven Years' War. This coalition would last from 1757 till 1762, and though it would bring stability to the government, its coalition would also turn the tide of war in North America. News of the massacre at Fort William Henry was shocking to the colonists. It also spurred a deep-seated hatred of the French and their native allies. After the massacre at Fort William Henry, the New York Mercury avowed, "How too certain that the growth of the British colonies has long been the grand object of French envy, and has said that their officers have orders to make the present war as bloody and destructive as possible." Benjamin Franklin even admonished that, quote, "It was useless to hope for a permanent peace so long as the French were masters of Canada." And though there were issues between British regulars and colonial militias, the devastation at Fort William Henry started a cooperation between the colonists and the British that had not been seen for years. For William Pitt, North America was to play a larger part in his global strategy to win the Seven Years' War. In 1758, William Pitt would put forth a three-prong offensive to win the French and Indian War. The first line of offense was to capture Louisburg, even though Loudon had failed to take it a year before. Pitt would not be deterred in putting forth effort to capture that fort and town. The second prong was to capture the French fort Carillon and St. Frederick. With those two forts captured, the path would be clear for the British to take Montreal. Pitt's final prong was to revisit General Braddock's road, seize Fort Duquesne, and then swing northward to Fort Niagara, cutting French ties between Canada and Louisiana. To fulfill this offensive, Pitt would commit 20,000 British regulars and 22,000 provincials to the coming campaign. Numbers such had never been before thrown into the balance of colonial conflicts. Pitt also began to put trust into the colonial government. He would turn recruitment and supplies over to local authorities, and he also promised to reimburse them for their efforts. While William Pitt renewed efforts in the campaigns in North America, Louis XV gave Canada very little, if any, attention at all. New France had a big problem, and that was its lack of an agricultural base within the colony. Essentially, New France was starving, and with France stretched thin in Europe, waging war on multiple fronts, much-needed supplies were very slow to reach her North American colonies. In order to carry out his plan to capture Louisburg, William Pitt appointed Admiral Edward Boscawen to lead a large force and sail from Halifax in the late May of 1758. They were to move up the coast and meet the ship that would carry Major General Geoffrey Amherst, who was now assigned to oversee land forces. The two were then to assess the situation and make plans for an invasion along the coast of Gabarus Bay. Having attempted a capture of Louisburg a year before, the French were prepared for another assault. The French commander, Chevalier de Drucourt, had spent time making preparations to repel the British and secure the fort along the shore of Gabarus Bay. To protect the harbor approaches, a total of 5 vessels were positioned beside cannon emplacements and entrenchments. On June 2nd of 1758, the British fleet sailed into Gabarus Bay. The fleet consisted of 157 ships and over 11,000 soldiers. The weather would delay Amherst's landing for several days, but on the 8th of June, the weather would abate sufficiently for the attack to be made. Under the leadership of Brigadier General James Wolfe, with the fleet guns of Boscawen providing support, Brigadier Generals Edward Whitmore and Charles Lawrence simultaneously attacked White Point and Flat Point, while Wolfe attacked Freshwater Cove. While Wolfe was in command of all the grenadier companies from the regiment, a band of marksmen known as the Light Infantry, a group of rangers and Highlanders, would make landfall despite the intensive fire. The French would be driven from their positions when Lawrence moved his brigade to their flank. The troops then had landed. Wolfe was instructed to maneuver around the bay and take Lighthouse Point as the British siege train approached Louisburg and lines were built across from its defenders. On June 12th, marching with 1,200 selected soldiers, he would accomplish this goal. By building a battery atop the point, Wolfe positioned himself to launch an attack against the harbor and the town's waterside. British artillery began firing on Louisburg on June 19th. The town's fortifications were weakened, and French gunpowder grew ineffective as the days went by. Despite Drucourt's will to endure, on July 21st, everything immediately went wrong for him. The ship Le Celebre was hit by a mortar round fired from Lighthouse Point during the ongoing bombardment. This resulted in an explosion and set fire to the vessel. Strong winds then caused the fire to spread, quickly consuming the 2 nearby ships, La Caprée, La Intrépanade. Drucourt had lost 60% of his naval strength in one blow. After 2 days, the King's Bastion was set on fire by British bombardment, making the French position even worse. One of the biggest structures in North America, the King's Bastion was located inside the fortress of Louisburg and functioned as the administrative center of the fortification. French morale was severely damaged by the fall of this and the destruction of Queen's Bastion shortly after. Boscawen set a cutting out team on July 25th to seize or destroy the 2 surviving French vessels. They burnt Prudent and took Bienfaisant by slipping into the port. After leaving the port, Bienfaisant sailed over to join the British fleet. The following day, Drucourt gave up the town, realizing that all was lost. The British casualties were around 500 killed and wounded. The French casualties are unknown, but are thought to have been substantial. 5,600 French soldiers surrendered with 200 cannon and munitions. The victory at Louisburg opened the way for the British campaign up the St. Lawrence River to take Quebec. Now, at the same time Pitt was making plans for Louisburg, General James Abercrombie was tasked with capturing Fort Carillon. The French had built Fort Carillon back in 1755. It was constructed in a location known as Ticonderoga, which is Mohawk for the place between the waters, near the southmost part of Lake Champlain. It oversaw the portage between Lake George and Lake Champlain. Abercrombie commanded the greatest force to have collected ever in North America up to this point. And he set out to take Carrion, with 6,000 British regulars and other troops being colonial-raised provincial troops. The overall strength of the force was over 12,000. Regiments of Scottish Highlanders, known for their fierce combat, were among the regulars. Abercrombie also had a very sizable artillery train for the fort's impending assault. On July 5th, 1758, just days before the siege of Louisbourg, Abercrombie's troops set off in an armada of more than 800 vessels and made landfall close to Fort Carrion. The 3,500-man garrison at Fort Carrion, under the command of Colonel Francois Charles de Bourlamaque, stood firm against the British assaults. The French commander in North America, Marquis Louis-Joseph de Montcalm, joined him days before on June 30th. Upon reaching Carrion, Montcalm discovered that the garrison was too small to defend the fort's surroundings and had only a 9-day supply of food. Montcalm asked Montreal for troops immediately to aid in the situation. Despite his lengthy tenure in the British Army, General Abercrombie was not a very effective leader. In order to make up for this, Pitt would put George Howe, a vivacious elder brother of Richard and William Howe, as Abercrombie's second in command. On July 6th, Abercrombie's forces marched north from the shore of Lake George in four columns. Howe led one of these columns, with the 55th Regiment accompanied by a unit of Connecticut militia, with Major Israel Putnam as a scout and guide. They made contact with a French detachment that had been separated from the main force, and a sharp skirmish ensued. They fought well, taking 148 prisoners and causing an estimated 300 enemy casualty, with limited losses to their own number. But one of those casualties was General Howe, who would end up dying in Israel Putnam's arms. His death would no doubt be a huge blow to morale. At the death of Howe, one British officer wrote, "In Lord Howe, the soul of General Abercrombie's army seemed to expire." See, Howe was widely mourned on both sides of the Atlantic. The Massachusetts Assembly would later vote to contribute £250 to place a monument to Howe in Westminster Abbey, a gesture that the Howe brothers would well remember when tasked to fight against the colonists years later during the Revolutionary War. See, William Howe had argued for fair treatment of the colonists as a member of Parliament. And many historians have speculated that William Howe may not have pursued Washington after he had retreated during the Battle of Long Island because of the soft spot the Howe brothers held for the colonists and the treatment and respect given to his fallen brother during the French and Indian War. But despite the loss of Howe, 2 days later, Abercrombie would choose to go forward with an infantry attack without bringing up any of his artillery in support after the military engineer, Lieutenant Matthew Clerk, was dispatched to assess the strength of the French defenders and stated that the position could be taken by infantry alone. Abercrombie would give the order for his infantry to organize, with 6 provincial regiments providing support for the 8 regular battalions in the front. By midday, this was finished, and Abercrombie planned to launch his attack at 1 p.m. Fighting, though, started at 12:30, when the forces from New York started to engage the enemy. As a result, there was a ripple effect, and individual troops started fighting on their own fronts. The British invasion had become fragmented and disorganized. Montcalm's soldiers open heavy fire on the British. The assailants would suffer heavy casualties as they got closer, and the French killed and disabled them easily. The initial assault had failed by 2 p.m. It's unclear, though, from sources if Abercrombie even made it to the battlefield, even while Montcalm was actively directing his soldiers. Throughout the day, Abercrombie kept ordering attacks, although this really did little but raise the death toll. The 42nd Regiment of Foot, known as the Black Watch, managed to breach the fort. But in the end, they were unable to overthrow the French. Later, as Abercrombie realized the extent of the loss, he gave the order for his troops to fall back, which led to a disorganized withdrawal to the landing area. The British force was across Lake George and headed south by the following morning. In the assault at Fort Carillon, the British lost 551 men, with 1,300 wounded and 37 missing, against the French casualties of 106 killed and 266 wounded. The defeat was one of the bloodiest battles of the conflict in North America and marked the only major loss for Britain of 1758. But despite the loss at Fort Carillon, the victory at Louisbourg was the turning point the British needed. The French would soon surrender Fort Frontenac on Lake Ontario on August 27, 1758, severing French communication lines to their troops in the Ohio Valley. In the fall, the British would establish peace with the Delaware, Shawnee, and Iroquois natives. And Pitt's third offensive would be successful on November 25, 1758, when Fort Duquesne was taken again by the British, who would rename it Pittsburg in William Pitt's honor. In the summer of 1759, the British finally succeeded in capturing Fort Carillon and renamed it to Fort Ticonderoga. By the end of July 1759, the British will also capture Fort Niagara, and the French will abandon Crown Point, leaving control of the western frontier to the British. In the fall of 1759, the British were preparing to invade Quebec. James Wolfe was named the commander of the British assault on the city. He was backed by a naval force led by Vice Admiral Charles Saunders. Wolfe's army would comprise of more than 8,000 British regular and nearly 900 American Rangers and colonial militia, as well as 2,100 Royal Marines. The French numbers would be more than 18,000 men. The majority of these, though, around 11,000, were Canadian militiamen who had little military training and very little battle experience. For months, the British and French had engaged in skirmishes. French General Bougainville repelled Wolfe, and Wolfe threatened French supply lines. Wolfe's goal was to actually try and draw Montcalm out to battle. But even with supply lines threatened, Montcalm refused, much to the disappointment and the bewilderment of his fellow officers. Wolfe wrote, "The Marquis of Montcalm is at the head of a great number of bad soldiers, and I am at the head of a small number of good ones that wish for nothing so much as to fight him. But the wary old fellow avoids an action, doubtful of the behavior of his army." Wolfe was preparing for a risky deployment upstream the St. Lawrence River, cutting Montcalm and his forces from Montreal. On September 12th, Wolfe was prepared to attack, writing, quote, "I had the honor to inform you today that it is my duty to attack the French army. To the best of my knowledge and ability, I have fixed upon that spot where we can act with the most force and are most likely to succeed. If I am mistaken, I am sorry for it and must be answerable to His Majesty and the public for the consequences." Wolfe's offensive strategy relied on surprise and secrecy. His plan called for a small group of men to land by night on the north shore and climb the promontory of Quebec, seize a small road there, and overpower the garrison that guarded it, allowing the bulk of his army, around 5,000 men, to ascend the cliff via the small road and then deploy for battle on the plateau. The British were lucky that the area was only weakly guarded. Although historians disagree over the reasoning and advantage of this choice, working in complete darkness and silence, the Navy boats battled the powerful St. Lawrence currents and successfully landed the advance force on September 13th, 1759, just after 4 a.m, led by Colonel William Howe, the future commander of British troops during the American Revolution. A British detachment of light infantrymen scaled the cliff and defeated the French advance guard. Wolfe and the 1st Division had arrived on the plateau by sunrise, around 8 a.m. The total force of 5,000 men had come together. The British Army formed a shallow horseshoe formation as it crossed the Plains of Abraham. Upon learning of the British landing and ascent, Montcalm made the hasty decision to launch an assault before the British could build any kind of foothold. His approach has drawn criticism from historians who contend that he ought to have waited for the arrival of reinforcements from nearby French detachments. According to one British soldier's account, the enemy lined the bushes in their front with 1,500 Indian and Canadians, and I dare say had placed most of their best marksmen there, who kept up a very galling, though irregular, fire upon our whole line. Historian Peter MacLeod has noted that some of the first shots fired during the battle were fired by native marksmen. Wolfe ordered his soldiers to charge their muskets with 2 balls each in preparation for the engagement. Captain John Knox, serving with the 43rd Foot, wrote in his journal that as the French came within range, the regiments gave them with great calmness as remarkable a close and heavy discharge as I ever saw. After the first volley, the British lines marched forward a few paces towards the shocked French forces and fired a second general volley that shattered the attackers and sent them into retreat. Wolfe had been struck in the wrist early in the fight, but had wrapped the injury and continued on. Volunteer James Henderson, with the Louisbourg Grenadiers, had been tasked with holding the hill and reported afterwards that within moments of the command to fire, Wolfe was struck with 2 shots, one low in the stomach and the second a mortal wound in the chest. Knox wrote that one of the soldiers near Wolfe shouted, quote, "They run! See how they run!" End quote. Wolfe, on the ground, opened his eyes and asked who was running. Upon being told that the French had broken, he gave several orders, then turned on his side and said, "Now God be praised, I will die in peace." With Wolfe dead and several other key officers injured, the British troops fell into a disorganized pursuit of the retreating French troops. During the retreat, Montcalm, who was still mounted, was struck by either canister shot from the British artillery or repeated musket fire, suffering injuries to the lower abdomen and thigh. He was able to make it back to the city, but his wounds were mortal, and he died at the wee hours the next morning. A few moments before he drew his last breath, Montcalm asked his sergeant how much time he had to live. "A few hours," he was answered. "All the better," he said. "I will not see the British in Quebec." He was buried in a shell crater left in the floor of the Ursuline Chapel by a British shell. In terms of casualties, the British suffered 658 killed or wounded. Of these, 61 officers and men were killed, and 597 were wounded. The French, on the other hand, had suffered around 644 to 716 killed or wounded. Among those, 13 officers and a further 350 men were taken prisoner. With Wolfe dead, Brigadier General George Townsend assumed command. Townsend's decision to entrench the British position instead of aggressively pursuing the French army had significant consequences. The French marched that night and bypassed their enemy on the way to Pointe aux Trembles, leaving only a small force in the town. The British laid siege to Quebec, and on September 18th, the French commander signed the Articles of Capitulation and turned the city over to the British. However, the war for New France would continue. By May of 1760, the French would try and fail to recapture Quebec. On September 8th, 1760, Montreal would surrender to the British. Days later, on September 15th, 1760, the British flag was raised over Detroit, effectively ending the French and Indian War. With the Treaty of Paris signed, France would secede most of its territories in North America to Great Britain. The French and Indian War constituted a watershed moment in history. We will see the cost of the war will prompt Britain to raise taxes in the colonies, which will lead for instability and growing distrust of the monarchy, prompting the rise of the Sons of Liberty. Are you guys excited to learn about the Sons of Liberty? Because I am so ready to start talking about those guys. We are going to be talking about Pontiac's Rebellion or Pontiac's War before we get to the Sons of Liberty. But we're almost there. I mean, we are getting close to this powder keg, the American Revolution. And I want to thank you guys for joining me. Let me know your thoughts in the comments below. And I will see you guys in the next one as we continue to journey down this road to revolution. Bye.